No, I didn't.
Okay. Alright. Let's get ready to start.
Roll.
So today, oh, I'm hoping more people will come. So let me get rid of the entrance music now. So we have two lectures left, and then I just want to give you a brief preview. So today we're talking about nucleic acids going, so we kind of finished talking about DNA at some point. And now we're going to go into see it work more people can. Chromosomes and genomes. All right. And from here on, so again, two more weeks, right? So next Tuesday, there's a lecture on mostly DNA replication, but I also try to, if I have time, to talk a little bit about what we talked about. If there's time, to summarize very briefly, so like what do you guys have to know and stuff like that. Hopefully I have enough time to do that, but nothing else. At least you guys should know replication by next week. It's going to be a quick tour. And then after that, the week after that, will be the great exam. The great exam. So let me just remind everybody, because you know you guys are here. So the 10th, one more lecture, mostly on replication. The 17th is going to be the exam, multiple choice, 46 questions. Between 40 and 46 questions. If I go over that, don't be annoyed too, because if I went over a lot on the replication, I can add more questions, just like that. Takes me like 2 minutes. So good luck again. You should not count on it being curved, because I think a lot of you know this material, so if some of you get like, you know, a good half the class is getting over 90%, that's difficult for me to do a curve. I guess I'm preaching to the choir, right? Those people who are going to fail are not here.
At least.
You're talking about the smart folks. anyway. So. And attendance, of course, there's a good 30% just for doing that.
Take roll as fast as you can.
Yeah. I have to take roll, by the way, by the first teamwork today. I got to remember to do that. So that's, and then afterwards Tom will come and then he'll lecture about other stuff. So why don't we just get started? So
we ended off at nucleosomes.
Yeah. A quick reminder about DNA, right? So DNA is an important part of this class. So just a quick reminder. Again, the different base pairings, pyrimidine, superidine. So you have either two hydrogen bonds or three. You notice that the ATs are a little bit weaker. So it turns out when you do that, you have strategic placement, actually, different base pair types. For example, when you want to open your helicase, you open your replication fork at certain places, you might want to do that near AT sites, for example. Again, the 5'3' structure is important. You have the sugar phosphate backbone, and that allows you to have this orientation when the DNA is actually round, like on top of each other, basically, in this double helical form. Somewhat similar to the single helical or the triple helical collagen guys earlier, just depending on how the chemistry works out. So this is what it looks like. It has a minor and a major curve, groove, sorry. And when replication happens, it relies on complementary base pairing. Okay. All right. So we talked a little bit about human karyotypes and animal karyotypes. And also the fact that it's kind of random how these guys are organized. It doesn't mean that you're more complex either way. But the number of genes are going to correlate with how complex the organisms are, generally speaking. Not a hard rule, but generally speaking.
The human genome has been counted, right?
It has been both counted and accounted for, which means it's been, you know, its bases have been sequenced. As some representative humans... DNA. I mean, I don't know how they came up with that, but actually some number of representative humans was But of course, I mean, it's just information, right? I mean, it's a good question, but there's no, without the context of knowing how those sequences work, it's kind of actually useless. So that's why now the next step is to figure out what those.
So is it possible for us not to know that this is a gene sequence when we're looking at a random arrangement?
Completely possible. Okay. Completely possible. In fact, that's the most likely thing you're going to see. If somebody gives you a, look, I mean, there's a possible question in an exam, in which, I'm not going to give it, but I could say, I give you the sequence, like, tell me what it does. And the correct answer will be no idea. No, because a priori, that's the most likely scenario, right? So when you're asked to select something on an exam, you give the most likely answer.
Do you even have a start codon?
Yeah, I mean, it might not finish. And even if it finished, that might not give a proper protein.
Okay.
Even if it has a start and a finished codon, you still don't know. You know, so, yeah. So anyways. Okay, so preliminaries out of the way. Now, the next two parts, actually, basically, I want to limit it to this today, because there's already like 50 or 60 slides just on this, but it's the organization of DNA. So the next time, we're talking about replication again. This time, we're talking about how DNA is organized, and it turns out it's more complicated than you would think, just from the double helix structure. Okay. So one thing is that because DNA has so much information, remember I said there's like 2 meters of it in a cell that you need to fit into this, you know, micron level, you know, diameter nucleus. What that means is you have additional units of complexity in terms of how you wrap them together. Not just double helix, just the fact that it wraps around the double helix doesn't help you enough. So one thing is that, so before I go into that, one thing is that the nucleosome is kind of the basic unit in which the DNA and the protein are kind of wrapped together. So when we say nucleosome, that means the DNA plus what I call histone units, which are the proteins around which DNA is organized. Okay, that kind of structure, unit structure, is called a nucleosome. Okay, that's because it's found in the nucleus, etc. Now, during interphase, you have decolonization of that. Bless you. So what that means is, outside of interphase, during, you know, kind of like getting ready to mitose, the cell is going to condense the DNA into these chromosome structures that's very well organized. But regionally, during interphase, you have decondensation, so that you have, let me say that more properly. During interphase, most of the time, the DNA is going to be like kind of all over the place, right? Condensed form. Wherever.
Condensed.
Yeah. Yeah. What? Yeah.
Condensed means taking up a smaller area because it's packed tighter.
Yes. Yes.
And
sorry.
That's what takes place during.
Hold on. Okay. So. Usually, it's kind of all over the place. It would be
decondensed.
It would be condensed.
All over the place is condensed.
I think. Because regionally, you want to have a certain place that's decondensed that you want to go into. And it's kind of confusing, isn't it?
It's semantics.
Wait, hold on. Let me get this straight. Okay, mitosis, you want to condense them into this form. Okay, sorry. I think I got that. Mitosis, you want to condense into this form. So usually it's decondensed.
There we go.
Usually it's decondensed. Right. So sometimes you want to kind of open up certain places that's like kind of decondensed so that you want to go into and do protein synthesis by doing transcription. Sorry, that's what I mean. So even during interphase, there are kind of stuff that you don't need that's sort of condensed but not chromosomally organized. That's what I want to say. So locally, you actually want to decondense a little bit so that the traffic can come in, the proteins can come in and actually transcribe genes out of them. Okay, that's what I mean by the decondensation part. Nucleosome is what I just said, which is the local structure of the DNA wrapping around the histone. So we're looking at sequences, right? chromosome is much more global. So chromosome is how these guys are organized on top of each other, because it's the karyotype thing I show you, right? This kind of thing, which is read off from, you know, these guys, which are big pieces. I mean, these are micron kind of pieces, angstrom type pieces, and that is an additional level of organization that I will get into. So in this lecture, I'm going from the low microscopic level, from the DNA and the nucleosome, into chromatin, into chromosome. Question. Yeah.
So when you said decondensed, that just means not in chromosome form, right?
Well, there's kind of two ways of thinking about it, but for the most part, that's what it is right now.
Okay.
Although it could also mean the chromatin organization.
Right, right.
When we talk about that, that would mean that, you know, it's not necessary that it's only condensed during mitosis. Like, because there's a lot of condensed and decondensed, like, shapes throughout the cell cycle. But actually, the right way to think about it may not necessarily be the condensation, but maybe just heterochromatinization. And I'll get into that. So in other words, how the chromatin themselves are kind of organized. And you're going to understand what that means when you say condensed condensation, when we talk about that, because the condensation actually involves local modifications of how the proteins are interacting. And then when you, so when I say decondensed, that means you kind of get rid of that clamp on ability to access the DNA. And then it's decondensed so that you can go in there and transcribe guys out. Yeah, good question. Okay, so nucleosome, like we're saying, DNA strings. So there's actually four types of histone cores. You don't have to know the details, but H2, H3, H4. And what you have is actually linker DNAs in between those cores. Right? So the core is where the DNA is being wrapped, and then the linker is actually joining them together, approximately every 200 nucleotides. Now, the DNA is actually, I mean, I guess we already talked about this more or less, but so DNA actually has these kind of loops, and then you can actually form sort of additional organization on top of the DNA. So this part is kind of complicated. It's kind of a phenomenon that's known as supercoiling. I'm sorry, I don't have this slide right here, but the supercoiling of DNA means that in addition to this double helical structure, you actually have the double helix round up amongst itself. Look, I guess I don't need to draw this out. Because, you know, so double helix, you form this kind of shape, right? But the additional steric effects within that actually allows you to have a coiling around of itself.
Yeah, pictures, right?
Yeah, there'll be. I'll show you later the pictures. So in other words, but basically DNA has additional structure on top of itself. And of course, we have to remember that you have the hydrogen bonding of also the histones themselves. So a lot of times the histones have some amino groups, and then these amino groups are going to interact with the phosphodiester groups of the DNA because they're positively charged with the negatively charged DNA. Remember, we pointed out earlier, DNA is actually -2, right, on each, you know, pair, basically, for the most part. I mean, there's a little bit of nucleotides in there, right, that could be positive. But for the most part, it's negatively charged. So what that means is that the histone actually, both the histone tail, which I'll talk about in a second, but also the histone core, actually interacts with the DNA in such a way so that the charged moieties kind of keep them around. So that's why the -2 charged DNA gets kind of wrapped around the histone, is because one of the reasons you have, for example, remember arginine, which is positively charged, one of the two positively charged guys, is going to kind of have enough charge to kind of keep these guys around. Okay? All right, so I'll show you. So the thing that I was talking about, the DNA being the additional level of coiling. That kind of gets into here where when it interacts with the histone, they kind of form these little loop structures also. I mean, that part is not critical, but here, let me show you a picture. So the chromatin, again, that's the vocabulary we give when it's in this microscopic form. It's not the chromosome, because chromosome is the big global form of the DNA. The chromatin is the organization of these nucleosomes. So nucleosome is each kind of individual bead here. People like to think of it as strings on, or beads on a string organization. So this kind of beads with the linker DNA strings taken together is chromatin. Right, that's the chromatin form. Histone are these little complexes. You notice that actually in the slide they actually show the four cores of the histone. So that would be the H2A, H2B, H3, H4. And then you have other additional proteins that are around. You know, for example, like polymerases, helicases, those kinds of guys. Right. This is what it looks like in the microscope or in the EM. Okay, so this is kind of the decondensed, more of a decondensed form. So, but once they kind of condense these guys out, you can actually see them better as an actual beads on a string. I shouldn't say use the word condensed. I should say that what they did is they denature them in such a way that, yeah, so that you can actually see the individual linker sequences. When you allow them to kind of nature themselves back together, it looks more like the A. So it really is kind of a beads on a string form. Again, so beads on a string organization, you have about 200 nucleotides of DNA in the linker, so in between every nucleosome complex. So what you can do when you study this is that you can actually digest the linker DNA, so you have specific restriction enzymes to get rid of those guys, for example. Or in this case, they're using a nuclease, right? It's more general. When you do that, you have a nucleosome core complex particle, right? So that's each part of your nucleosome. And so that's how they study this, is when they use the salt. They put in salt to denature it. So why do you put in a salt? No, because remember, because DNA negative charge with the positive charges of histone, right? Salt is NaCl, right? That's how you get rid of these guys, right? So, yeah. So once you do that, you get dissociation of the histone. So histone, I should say, it's a little bit more complicated than just the four units like that. So it turns out it's an octameric, but it's, you know, that's not a big deal. But, you know, that's why there's like H2A, but then H2A has its own A and B, you know, part. So when you dissociate that, then you can study these individual proteins. Yeah. This is what kind of the histone core complex looks like. So you notice here that from the side and the edge view that DNA is actually wrapped around in that loop structure that I was saying earlier. And these guys in color are the ones that are the histones. Right? So very well wrapped. Histones actually look pretty similar in terms of each of their cores. Right? So you notice that when you actually look at how the proteins look like, they look pretty similar, although they're not identical. Okay. And the N and the C terminal. And remember, the N terminal is positive, right? So you have some positive guys going over there, and they can interact well. And the C terminals, they're just hitting around somewhere. So you notice when they're organized, so this is kind of what I was saying, but when they're organized into an octamer, so this is actually kind of important, the N side actually kind of sticks out, right? But that's consistent with what we were talking about, because the N side, you have these positive charges, right? Remember, you have the amino acid with the N side positive with the COO minus side slightly negative. So what you want to do is actually have these N groups hang out, because then you attract the DNA. right? So that part's, you know, kind of important. So that means the histones actually have these end groups hanging out on the outside. Yeah. Okay, so that's what histones, I know it's a little bit fast, but that's what the histones actually look like. But it turns out you have other proteins just to get you into that structure, right? So I want to talk in this slide about chromatin remodeling complexes, right? So what they do is actually they are able to modify the histone content. In other words, which subunits are in there, how precisely are they binding the DNA, for instance. Okay? So first of all, DNA is actually kind of found in this structure, in kind of a loop structure within this octamer, right? So it turns out it's kind of approximately 1.7 turns within this octamer structure. So what you can do, like I was saying earlier, is because the N-terminal tails are actually the kind of key reactive components, I guess you would say, for the histone, what you can do is actually covalently modify those guys. If you covalently modify them, that allows you to have access to DNA or not. Right? Because the N-terminal positive charges, if you modify them, now you can release DNA or not. So that's kind of the key place where you actually want to have, modulation, basically, modification, right? And that's actually, similar to what chromatin remodeling complexes do. But first, remember that these guys are probably the most highly conserved genes. So the actual guys are coding for the histones themselves, the DNA, which is wrapped in some chromatin with some histones, which happens to code for those histones, are some of the most highly conserved. Right? So remember what I said about high conservation, right? If they're highly conserved, that means any changes to their sequence leads to something lethal and they won't survive. And over evolutionary time, different species have homologs that look almost the same, right, with very small number of variations across different species, meaning that histone complexes evolve well early in the DNA life, right, RNA-DNA life, so that it's actually very well understood and also well conserved within evolution. Okay, now... Let's go on to about chromatin remodeling. So chromatin remodeling complex is different proteins, right? So different proteins. So what they do is, in order to kind of get that DNA off that, histone tail kind of complex with histone cores, what they do is they actually have to use ATP to move them out. Because, there's a lot of charge interactions there, so it takes energy to get rid of those. And it's not, by the way, it's not just the charge interaction, too. It's also the way that it's wrapped around. A lot of it's the geometry, because you have these guys that are wrapped around these guys. So even weak interactions like van der Waals forces keep that guy in shape, right? So actually, it's not... And in fact, this is important, because when you remodel with the complex and you loosen up the tail and the DNA kind of binding, it's not like flying away. And that's because of things like van der Waals interaction, hydrogen bonding still, right, still part of it. So it doesn't actually kind of move out of the way. So that's actually how it kind of relies on, and how the remodeling complex relies on the different biochemical properties of this interaction to do its work. So what they say is actually called like kind of nucleosome sliding. So what that means is just like you kind of slide off a piece of the histone and then kind of put a different piece in whenever it needs to. Okay, so...
Like piece of histone, you mean core?
Core, right. Subunits. So if you have to exchange, for example, a histone core in and out, because it's going to modify the property of how... Well, you can access the DNA, depending on which core complex, core subunit. I know it's very, very complicated kind of thing. But basically, the idea is that, you know, the global idea is just the DNA is wrapping these guys, but these guys themselves have to be modified, configured in certain ways. It makes sense, right?
So, like, would it be fair to say that this, like, if you have four H4 units, then the DNA would be wrapped very, very tightly around them, whereas if you had four H2B units, they'd be wrapped, like, loosely.
Yeah, I don't know in vivo if that actually occurs with the H4, because it kind of depends on the geometry of how okay. the... Because you might have requirements for, say, oh, you have to have a... I actually don't know the answer, but, you know, say if you have to have a 2A or you have to have some form of A2 in order for this to even exist in a complex form.
It exists, as in the bonding won't happen?
Right, right. So there's two kind of... Good question. Basically, there's kind of two limitations, right? So one is how the DNA is bound around a histone. But the other thing is that because histone is itself an octameric protein, you have to respect how its subunits themselves are actually configured within themselves, because the geometry of a protein determines how well they can fit together.
So histones aren't all the same?
No. Yeah, I know. It's a big surprise,
okay.
right? No, histones are not all the same. That's why you need remodeling with these chromatin remodeling complexes to kind of push things out. You think of it as kind of a, you know, little screw cap kind of thing. You push something out, you push something back in. Now, you don't have to know the level of detail, like exactly what's going on there, but that's what it does. And actually, it works with chaperones. Do you guys remember what chaperones are? So you should know for exams. Yeah, those guys actually help to fold certain proteins in the cell. And of course, there's stuff to also help histones fold, right? And actually, they work together with histone chromatin remodeling complexes to do its work when you need to kind of remove a piece of a histone, put a different one in, etc. Now, nucleosomes, in terms of their actual positioning, in other words, how they're positioned within the cell, also kind of depends on the proteins, whether proteins are tightly bound to it. So you have regulator proteins that are kind of telling you where they should be. And also, when I say dynamic, that just means that they don't necessarily stay in one place, depending on what the cell needs to do. If it's a fibroblast that needs to like grow quickly, for example, it's going to want these guys in a particular position where it's easy to get access to DNA, for example. So basically, it's a very dynamic structure all around. Chromatin remodeling comes in, boom, exchanges guys in and out, depending on the situation, depending on how the cell has to interact with its environment. Sure. It's a complex. So I'm going to go right into that right now. So, you know, I didn't show you the pictures, so I'll show you the pictures. But it's a little bit, it's more of a complex. That's why it's not just a single protein. Good question. So this is what it looks like. It actually kind of prefers to have the minor groove kind of interact. But it's not, you don't have to really know about that. But basically, it's the minor groove part that's kind of bound to this histone core. This is what it more or less looks like. You have a surface in which you can interact with these guys. You don't have to know the details of ATGC guys right now. Okay, so this is the remodeling complex I was saying. So the remodeling complex you see is quite a beast, right? Because the histone is drawn here. So again, you remember what I said, it requires ATP, right? So in order to have a kind of a sliding of the nucleosome, what that means is you kind of slide that DNA off a histone, basically. So you kind of move, in this picture, you can see this blue band, I guess, which is a gene, is actually sliding off to the left here, right? So kind of hidarigawa, right? So in order to do that, you actually need ATP hydrolysis so that it can break some bonds in there and kind of allow it to reform. Yeah, I know it's crazy, right? You can actually do that. But how are you going to access guys that are in the core of the histone? You can't access them unless they're kind of out, right, somehow, right? So that's also basically how you exchange these guys. Also, you can kind of slide off, and then now you can push that core guy out and put in the core guy, right? This is what it looks like. It looks like a bed of roses, you know, huge complexes. So that's what nucleosome sliding is. So this is a little bit more complicated, but this is the exchange, right? So yeah, you don't have to know all the details, but basically you have a chromatin complex here. You also need an ADP hydrolysis in order to kind of have this exchange mechanism happen. So what happens is that you have interaction with the chaperones, I was saying. The chaperone also helps, but it forms some intermediate complex in which you hydrolyze ATP. Boom! Energy happens, and energy allows reactions to happen. You kind of poke out those histone guys and put in the new guy. And when you put in the new guy, and I guess this is why the histone is also important, right? Because the histone has very tight binding with the finished product, right? Because that's what allows it to fold, right? If it looks like the finished product, the active site, then it attracts them to get into the finished product. But now the cell is smartly using them for its own good, not only for how you're folding the histone, but also in getting them off. Because look, if the histone chaperone is a little bit farther away, and you get that histone to come off through the tight binding, that also means a different chaperone, or you know, that's grabbing a different subunit of that core, can come in and through ATP hydrolysis put you guys back into this form. The long and short story of it all is that you can exchange and slide using these processes, right, with the chromatin remodeling complex and the chaperones interacting together using ATP. Yeah.
So, what's the benefit of it being in a nucleosome form during interphase? Is information easier to access this way, or?
Well, it's more or less always in the nucleosome form, because it's always tightly bound in that way. The question is whether the additional level of condensation, whatever, has to do with kind of chromatin modulation. So whether you put, that's the next thing. Right, but the question of why you want it in this particular way of organization is it gives you very fine control. Like, it's not just DNA everywhere, right? If you're just DNA everywhere, where would you know where to go, right? But here, you can read off the markers on the histone, for example. If you modify the histone with some group that's very characteristic, boom, you know. You go into that histone first, and then you say, well, okay, I know it's somewhere around this site. It just gives you an additional organization, you know, and that organization allows you to have finer control. All right. So, in addition to that beads in a string, I was saying, you actually need additional level of basically coiling, binding, packing, okay? Because it's just not, even that bead in a string is not enough to get you to that finished, really tightly bound product. So what that means is that nucleosomes actually kind of pack on top of each other. So nucleosome on top of nucleosome. So first you imagine the beads on the string, and then you kind of imagine coiling that bead of a string on top of itself. The end product of that is this 30 nanometer fiber, okay? Now, there's actually, you know, we're not going to go into the details, but there's actually different models for how you're doing this stacking of the nucleosome, okay? The most basic one is zigzag, which just means zigzag, zigzag, okay? I'll show you a picture later. When you actually look closely using microscopy, you can actually see that another different model of stacking, which is called kind of solenoidal stacking, also seems to have evidence for that in vivo with the cell. So I think I'm going to skip sort of these more Well, let's look at the picture first. I'll come back to it. Okay, so this is what kind of the zigzag model looks like. So you have these nucleosome. All right, looks like a bunch of toys zigzag together. And actually, you have these kind of histone tails that are sitting off of it, right? Remember the positively charged guys that are coming out? And then it really looks like that in vivo, right? So, it turns out, actually, there's some... Again, you don't have to know this, but it turns out that there's actually additional levels where there has to have specific subunits at certain places. So in this case, actually, it turns out the histone H1 kind of has to fit in that groove, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But you don't have to know that.
All the DNA in the nucleus one continuous strand in this situation?
Yeah, actually, it's all one continuous...
Okay, and it only splits into 46 or whatever during the cell division.
Ah, I see. So you're saying when the chromosome forms... Does it form from actual 46 different... No, no. I think what happens is that it was already organized into chromosome forms.
Okay.
But
there's an appropriate, major zigzag structure of histone that corresponds to chromosome 20-something already.
No, no. They all have this property. So each chromosome, right, it's when they're decondensed, you can't tell that they're individual chromosomes, but they actually still have organization where these guys are kind of locally next to each other, you know, that kind of thing. And actually that is how you actually have still some local structure within the nucleus, nucleolus also, right? Because it's just the chromosome formation is just coming in from, you know, the process that kind of initiates, oh, I need to do mitosis, now I just kind of wrap those guys around and kind of condense form. You know, we talk about that a little bit later also. So let me get back to this, is that you actually have to, I guess I skipped the H1 part, you don't have to know that. So, it's too much detail here. But what you do is actually the linker DNAs actually are not always the same length because of the sliding. You slide it out, right, and you have different lengths, right? And even if you slide it back in, it might not be the same place. You know? So there's a lot of variations in that, and that allows you to actually also have to find things.
Linker DNA is also coding DNA, right?
Yeah. I mean, linker DNA is... Well, I think the percentages are different, though.
Okay.
Yeah, the percentages are probably lower. So let me... I'll talk about that later.
I was concerned for a bit.
Yeah. Linker DNA actually have some... It's less functional, I guess, but yeah. Okay, so when the DNA is actually kind of in this condensed form, so basically have lack of access to the actual DNA information, then it's called heterochromatin. Okay, so that's why I was saying earlier that we should really say whether it's heterochromatin or not, you know, because that's the technical jargon that people usually use. Okay, so the short answer, first of all, is that when it's in this heterochromatin form, it's you can't express these genes very well because the protein is modifying them. Okay, so it turns out, actually, the heterochromatin organization actually... Have you guys heard of the term epigenetic?
Mm-hmm.
So epigenetic means that it's something outside the actual DNA sequence that you're getting information from. So, and this information is inherited, for example, from mother to son, etc. Right? So the epigenetics of the situation actually means that this chromatin structure and how you're modifying it lasts more than just that kind of cell cycle, basically. Okay? And how you do that is you basically have covalent modification, right, within the histone complex, and it allows you to have sites for which proteins can bind and interact, either to regulate or to transcribe, right? So when you have this condensed form, the heterochromatin, again, does not allow you to access the genes very well. But in some DNA kind of sequences, you don't need access, right? For example, the centromere part, which binds the kind of different sister chromatids together in chromosome, well, you know, you don't need to express genes in that. There's not much going on there. And similar with telomeres, which are at the ends of the cells, they're just there kind of for protection. And so you don't really need that. So those guys are actually well condensed in this heterochromatin form with protein modification. Okay. So you can't have access to DNA very well. It turns out they're kind of what are called like positional effects. So what that means is that depending on where the non-heterochromatinized DNA is in respect to the heterochromatin, you can have positional effects in terms of whether it's going to be silent or versus expressive. So for example, if you have, I'll show you a picture. Let's see here. Hold on. I think it's probably look better to look at this. Yeah, so here what's shown is that you have heterochromatin, which again, you can't express those guys very easily, and if you do, you need stuff to do in order to get into shape. But for most part, it's in this bound form, and these genes are not being expressed, right? Now, you have another gene here called white. It's just the name of the gene, but it basically has to do with whether you're expressing kind of a certain color in the eye of this Drosophila fly, right? And you actually have this barrier DNA, which kind of stops the heterochromatin from invading the the real gene, basically. So complicated, right? But in this case, what happens is that you have this inversion, right? In which you, if you just imagine, you're inverting this whole piece, right? When you do that, now the barrier goes away. Now, this guy is still not heterochromatin. So, in other words, it still can be expressed, right? But now it's close to the heterochromatin. And this is what I was saying with positional effects. Because it's close, now their complexes are now able to invade it much more readily. And when it does invade the sequence, if you notice that actually you only get partial expression because a lot of these genes are now being turned off or at least partially turned off. So that's what's mean by positional effects. So, okay.
White gene?
So when you go to the heterochromatin,
less likely to be expressed, right? Because remember, before there was a barrier there. The barrier stops the heterochromatin from ever invading this gene. So this gene just goes boom, boom, boom. Now it's called white, but actually it causes red expression. Yeah. But that's just the name of the gene. You don't have to worry about the name. It's confusing. Sorry. But when you invert them or whatever, or you could just excise the barrier too, right? There's many ways of doing this. But when you're doing that, then you're close to heterochromatin. Heterochromatin likes to basically go as far as it can, basically. So the proteins modifications, they keep modify. I'll show you a little bit of that later, but basically they like to spread themselves. Okay. So that's what the that's what positional effects mean. And the other thing, the positional effect variation is pretty similar. Basically, you have a zone of inactivation that's caused by the heterochromatin. That's why it's inactivated, right? Because it's heterochromatinized. And that actually can be inherited. For example, the most famous example is the female X chromosome, right? There's two of them, so you basically don't need the other one. So really, the other one just gets inactivated. And it's basically heterochromatin, basically inactivating the whole thing, right? Now, if you damage one of them, then you have another copy, but for the most part, they don't need to be hyper-expressed. You only need one gene to be nice and early. That's cool. To be expressed. Okay, yeah.
Sorry.
Sure.
What exactly do you mean by invade?
In, It just means that these, I'm going to talk about that in more detail later, but basically the heterochromatinization is always kind of, the proteins that make it happen is always pushing forward on them, basically. There's actually a protein that, yeah.
Okay, so you covered the bead and the beads and the string and the packing whatsoever. What's the alternative? Just the string?
Yeah, I mean, it always is more or less found in this form, but, I mean, what do you mean by alternative?
Well, what's the difference between heterochromatin and chromatin, non-condensed heterochromatin and regular, like, what's the opposite? Well, what's its alternative?
No, heterochromatin is a different thing. Heterochromatin is where you kind of basically have protein modification, covalent modification, that restricts access within this bead on a string thing. The nucleosome itself is always kind of organized in this form.
Oh, so beads on a string, and zigzag beads on a string.
It's an additional level of complexity. So first, I want you guys to get it clear, is that the beads on a string nucleosome thing is what I talked about before. Not really associated with this. It's just that the way that is organized. Now, when you need to access those guys, then you do sliding or exchange, whatever, right? But this is a on top of that. So beyond that, once it's found the zigzag form with the 30 nanometer fiber, then you have an additional level where you can actually modify and, you know. So anyway, I go into a little bit more detail as we go into that. So that's a condensed form. Okay. So, I mean, this is just talking about how you have heterochromatization, right? So let me just go straight into it. So, I talked about this a little bit, but I'll go into just a little tiny bit of a detail about, I know, this chapter is tough. I know you guys. This chapter is tough. Just hang around and then it'll get better. Next chapter is much easier, actually. So,
I'll accept this as chapter.
Yeah, that's why you guys have to be here today. So, and notice the lack of jokes today, right? Because, man, this is serious shit, man. Serious shit. And also because it's just, yeah, it's hard stuff. Okay, so remember we have these histone tails. Again, you don't have to know that much detail, but I give it to you so that you guys remember it better. Now, these kind of histone tail areas can be covalently modified. This is basically how you get into heterochromatin, right? There's additional protein complexes, but this is basically it. So with these side chains, you can actually acetylate them, right? You can acetylate the lysine type parts. You can methylate them. You can also phosphorylate them.
Wait, what's a side chain?
This is the tails of the histone that you can modify.
Yeah. Tails and side chain. What's a side chain if it's not a
tail? Ah, I see. The side chains are just kind of sitting in a different position, but the tails are the important ones. You don't have to worry about the side chains.
You're talking about.
Yeah. It's the tails that are coming off. That's the guys you. You can also modify the side chains.
So there are 12 tails, except 8 of them happen to be the end term histone tails, and 4 of them are just random flailing.
Yeah. But basically, there are stuff on the histones,
okay.
Most of them are tails, that you can modify.
Okay.
I know you're getting hung up on the specific detail,
no,
but I'm actually trying to highlight the stuff you don't need to know.
I'm trying to read that.
I know. No, it's good.
Does it have 12 tentacles? Or
I love your intellectual curiosity. So there's 12 of them, but 8 of them are tails.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great. I got to be careful what I put on slides. So there's actually proteins that actually does this, right? So enzymes, right? So they're actually transferases. That just means that you put in something, take something out. In this case, the end product is you put on the acetyl thing into the lysine, right? But anyways, it just puts something on. You can also remove it, and there's actually enzymes to remove it as well. It turns out this type of modification is reversible. So unlike, for example, you know, DNA synthesis or something, which is irreversible more or less, right, unless you put really something strong there, this guy's actually, you can actually reversibly do this. So they actually going to put, so enzymes are actually going to be recruited to do this, at different parts of the cell cycle, and it does that by having regulation proteins that are next to it, giving them a marker to, oh, let's come modify these guys. So what that means is that the modification actually can persist, because if you put on an acetyl group or a particular methyl group, and this happens in DNA as well, well, that's going to sit there. If you don't do anything to it, it's going to sit there, and nobody's going to come, right? Because methyl group, remember, neutral charge, kind of hydrophobic-like, you know, basically you, once it's there, it's just kind of sitting there, right? You can't access them very well. Right, so they're going to kind of persist, and that makes sense because you want epigenetic modification outside just DNA sequences, right? So the protein level inheritance, basically. So again, when you acetylate, so these different modifications all do different things, but for example, when you do the acetylation on the tails, then what you do is you kind of remove the positive charges and you kind of allow the chromatin structure to be kind of loosened, and that recruits certain proteins that can come in and recognize the acetylation. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm still confused about epigenetics.
Okay, that's a good question, yeah. So epigenetic just means that it's outside the actual sequence of DNA what happens to the actual information that you need. So in this case, what I'm saying is how you accessing the DNA. I mean, there's many different types of epigenetic modification, but inheritance. But in this case, it's saying how you can access the DNA is being inherited.
But this information is stored in the DNA, though.
No, well, this information is... It's not stored per se in the DNA because the enzyme comes in and recognizes a certain particle and does something to it. So it's not per se in the DNA sequence. It's not specified per se by the DNA sequence. It's kind of, it's modifying those sequences, and once it does that, it's epigenetic. It's outside the DNA sequence themselves. I mean, I think what you're saying is like chicken or the egg. Eventually, it's still, yeah. Right? But that's not what people say when they say epigenetic. When they say epigenetic, that just means I'm not changing the DNA sequence. That's not the thing being inherited. The thing that's being inherited is how those guys are modified in this particular case. You see what I'm saying? So if you methylate them, it's an epigenetic modification. It's outside the genetic code, right? Like when you're putting a methyl group somewhere, either on DNA or on histones or whatever, to change access to them, that is outside the sequence, right? The sequence.
But what triggers the methylation?
Well, I mean, that's many things. It could be from the environment. It could be all kinds of things.
Oh, so there isn't actually a DNA reading that says you enzyme methylates.
No. That's why it's epigenetic.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
No, it's more complicated because there could be things that, you know, came in, gave a signal, went into the nucleosome. But for the most part, when they say epigenetic, that just means it's outside the actual sequence. You don't really have to know that much more.
So it's just like we have this enzyme now, and then the actual methylation with this enzyme is not coded.
No. Epigenetic just means the methylation itself.
The methylation itself.
That thing is the modification that you're inheriting. But that thing is not ATGC. Therefore, it's epigenetic. That's all it means. Yeah. It's actually slightly more simple than you would think in terms of the terminology. Yeah, so.
Methylation is the
both. But this lecture, I'm talking about the histones. That could be confusing.
And then, like, how can, like, once the cell is divided into two, like, how can the epigenetic information be passed on to the next generation?
Yeah, that's a good question. So basically, when this is kind of getting back to the methylation and acetylation stuff, right? Once it's methylated, unless you go in there and fix that methylation, it just stays on. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because, I mean, methyl groups don't just come out. You need methyl transferases and stuff.
If you need two copies of that chromosome, then you have to make the identical histones to keep the epigenetic information.
That's true, that's true. So what happens is that when you're doing the replication, I mean, this is a little bit detailed, but when you're doing the application, funky things happen to allow you to have some sort of access so that you're copying, et cetera, but it's maintaining that structure somehow. Yeah. That part's a little, yeah, I see how you can...
Another question is like,
yeah.
So the sideline DNA sequence that is bound into the histone, is that always the same part of the sequence?
What do you mean, in terms of sliding?
No, I mean, like, for example, this gene was bounded with the histones, but... after replication, is it still bounded to the histone? I mean, is that possible, like, the position of histones can change?
I think it's more dynamic. It's usually being changed a lot, all the time. So in terms of what you can access or not access. So, yeah, I guess the answer is no, because you don't always keep it. Now, it doesn't mean that it might not stay there, right? So, for example, if you have heterochromatin that's, like, kind of just stuck in that form, nothing much going to change that much, even when the guys come in and do their replication machinery and stuff like that. But most situations, it's very dynamic, so you have sliding and stuff coming in and getting off. Yeah. But, I mean mutations also happens, right? So this... You know, there's a lot going on in there, and that's why sometimes you actually want to protect them. And actually, the methyl groups actually protect DNA when we're talking about DNA also. So it's also a level of protection. Yeah.
I mean, like heterochromatin, where the epigenetic modifications happen or not?
Right. It's one of the places where you can have epigenetic modifications, yeah. Yeah.
That question, like,
sure. No, it's a good question.
You always sound like DNA is the, like, carries the information that passed down from the parents to child to children.
Yeah.
But in this case, the epigenetic information is not really part of the DNA.
Right. Exactly.
So, but like in the beginning, people said protein is not the. It doesn't really matter in gene expression. So, I mean, like, proteins also has the same role as DNA. It's also, like, some of the characteristics.
Well, it's a different type of... I mean, this is not the sequence information it's getting, right? This is just protein modification making a difference in terms of how the inheritance actually happens because of a restriction of access to the DNA. You see what I'm saying? The DNA still contains the information, but the expression of it differs based on whether they're being modified or not. So based on whether you're getting access to them or not.
Like a gene is not accessed. Doesn't mean like it's just like each one or something. It's turned off forever.
Yeah, I mean it's turned off until in this case, it's well protected enough that you're not seeing the phenotype of this gene. So that's something you can inherit, right? I mean, that's a significant thing. You're not getting that protein ever because you heterochromatinized it. That's what it means for epigenetic modification. Yeah. Somebody, I don't know who's first here.
Is this modification is something that happens in like super early stage of life, or is it just like say this part of my body has that certain modification?
Yeah, I don't think it's generally always early, you know. But yeah, I think there were some studies looking at. I don't know the detail. I shouldn't say, but yeah, it's not like only one certain stage of life, but when it does happen, you can inherit it. You know, the cells basically inherit it. Like, so the cells, when they're found that form, they're going to keep being in that form unless something else happens.
Yeah. So it's coded, not coded, but it's part of their sex cells too? When they, I don't get how it can be inherited if it starts after you're like...
Oh, like how it gets started in the first place?
Yeah.
You know, certain environmental things, right? I mean, it's kind of, you know, just like mutations, it's like things just happen. But once it does get there, when it's in a form in which it's difficult to change, it gets inherited. That's basically...
So, but then that would mean, like, all of our cells will have to be...
That particular sequence, that particular, right.
Okay,
it gets preserved over time. That particular, yeah.
Gets preserved over time.
Yeah. That's what it means by epigenetics. And that's actually, it turns out there's a lot of things that are epigenetic. So that is not just DNA specific things. And most of that is you kind of, some proteins doing something so that it changes how you're accessing certain things. But you're keeping track of those changes. So actually disease also is, right? Because all you care about is the phenotype, right? So however way you want to affect the phenotype, it doesn't mean it has to be DNA, right? There are certain things you can do to the phenotype outside the DNA that as long as you keep track of it, right? It doesn't mean you're... No, it's not impossible to change afterwards, but it just means that you can inherit it.
So is it possible? So, like, the only example I have so far when it comes to diseases is like radiation permanently affecting the DNA chain.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a form of like epigenetic change, if it were ingrained in your DNA structure so far.
Well, but you're changing the DNA sequence.
So is it possible to have a trauma?
Uh-huh.
That doesn't physically affect your DNA, but to be passed on to your offspring.
That's
the epigenetic. Not trauma, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I see what you're saying. So you would have to... No, it's possible because you just need some sort of protein modification that gets
okay.
into that specific thing that you want to change.
Okay.
It's not likely, right? Because it's very specific.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So why don't we, you know, because we're kind of, I need to get to the first set of questions. So why don't we just move ahead? I will try to kind of be a little bit more in less detail. So this is what we're talking about when we're talking about acetylation and methylation of these histone tails. The only important thing here is that they compete against each other. So when you acetylate, you no longer can methylate. That makes sense, right? Because look, when you acetylate, you get the COCH3 group, right? There's no way you're going to methylate that group easily. I mean, there's nothing to methylate, really, right? And similarly, when you look at the methylation, right, you have dimethylation and trimethylation. So they compete with each other. What that means is when it's methylated, it stays methylated for a while. Okay, and then same idea with serine, right? So that's the other type of covalent modification.
This is a process that's not reversible.
It is reversible, but you need something to come in and make this reaction happen. Yeah. Okay. Skipping that. So there's a histone code. So we talked about a little bit about this, but basically you have different variants of the histones that are made in interface. It's not just like kind of the major histones, and actually you kind of put them in by the remodeling complexes. In the using the mechanisms that I talked about earlier, where you have the sliding and you put those guys in. Now the histone code just means that this guy now allows you to have access in different situations, whether they depending on the biological function that you need. You know, whether you can recruit certain proteins, when you're going to turn this thing on versus turn this thing off. And it turns out you actually have. Oh, this is. I don't know if it's a little bit of detail, but I'm trying to see what I see. But basically, okay, let me just show you this. Okay, let me show you this picture. Okay, I'm just going to go for the picture. I think that's easier. So So, you have these, that's not important. Okay. I need to skip this, actually. Because, okay, I'll give you the very kind of short story. But basically, there's also these other proteins called scaffolding proteins and reader complexes. So these guys actually go in there, and basically what happens is that when you have a reader protein bind, it attracts other proteins. They come in with more binding sites, and it's basically able to... This is the mechanism that allows you to actually extend your heterochromatization. And the way it does this is it does... Ignore this one. Just listen to it. Just forget about it. Just forget about everything that is on the slide, because I don't have time to go over it. So, how do you extend these heterochromatization? Why is it that I said earlier that when you put a gene next to a bunch of heterochromatinized genes, you kind of get spreading activation, right? The reason is, these guys come in, they read what's going on in the modification, not the sequence. They read the modification. So if you notice in the picture here, it's reading the tails, right? You notice that? So what that means is that it reads the tail, writes the next guy. As it reads one, it writes the next guy. It reads it, writes the next guy. But these guys are promiscuous. Yay, I got to use that word. That's the whole point of this class, right? It's promiscuous, right? Keeps going unless something happens. So unless you get to a barrier sequence, for example. Right? So what that means is you're getting spreading activation. You attach other guys as you're doing this additional level of methylation, acetylation, etc. Right? So this is kind of what it usually means. Usually you have gene expression, but when you trimethylate them, you're silencing them, right? But these reader complexes go and read and write methylation and acetylations into the actual chromatin structure. Yes.
So the barrier is just the like that specific tail sequence is what stops the.
Yeah, it's not clear. I don't know, actually. I don't know. It's not clear to me what the actual barrier, what is it about the barrier that stops it. Yeah, I'm not sure. It could be the DNA sequence, but I don't know how is it that. It's likely to have some protein there that's doing something. Yeah. Okay. So this is what it looks like. It's better to kind of show you this picture, I think, I realized. So you have a regular protein that allows you to start this process. You have the writer protein come in, and it writes that first guy, and then it reads and writes and reads and writes and reads and writes and keeps going. And you have a spreading wave of chromatin.
And it doesn't read the red stuff.
Huh?
It doesn't read the red stuff.
It doesn't read the stuff. Right. It doesn't read the red stuff, and it doesn't read beyond this point on the left here either. And it doesn't read beyond that DNA barrier sequence thing. Right. Okay. So is that more or less...
No.
Okay. Satisfied. So the next few slides, I can basically talk about centromeres, which are this... No, again, ignore the slide for now. It's for me to remember what I need to tell you. Okay. So the centromeres, again, is the part of that DNA which basically... First of all, they're heterochromatinized, okay? So it means you're not expressing guys from them. And then what happens is basically you have a site in the centromere that allows you to kind of bind a couple of proteins that allows you to have this mitosis process where you're taking the sister chromatids apart. And that's also the part where you're joining them together. Now, in the actual centromere itself, it has this thing called a CEMPA histone. Okay, it's the thing, it's nothing complicated, it's just a name, but it's just the histone that allows you to have the proteins to bind to the central. That's all it is. Okay, that's all it is. It's called centric because it's centromeric, so it's centromeric heterochromatin. When you have these histones there, then it allows you to have a place where you can bind this kinetochore complex, which is a complex of the protein that contains the CEMPA. And that allows you to have attachment of the spindles. So the spindles are going to attach to protein. It's not going to attach to the actual nucleotides, right? But in order to have that, you need the histone there, the CEMPA. Okay. A quick thing I want to go over, actually, because it's on exam, is...
No, actually,
I'm just picking and choosing based on what is on the exam. I'm just going to teach you this because it's on the exam, for example. So, in humans, actually, you have these alpha satellite DNA, in a centromere. So, centromere is, you guys are okay now, right?
No.
Except for you, it's okay. So, what happens is kind of...
Okay.
So what happens in humans is actually it's packaged into these kind of alternative blocks. So when we say alternative block, it just means that it's not in every sequence. It's just that these DNA sequences are kind of found organized into blocks, okay, in these centromere areas. Now, it actually these DNA actually allows you to kind of seeding means allows you to seed the centromere. So what that means is that allows you to kind of have the organizations of the centromere so that you have additional modifications to them. So that's what it means by kind of the seeding. But you don't, they're not completely necessary, but it's nice to have them there. So when you have them, you have more probability for the seeding to happen. Now, there's also non-satellite DNAs, and those are called neocentromeres in humans as well, but that's a different thing. That's in different in fragments and areas. So the short answer is that in the centromeres in humans, right, you actually have an additional kind of organization basically dependent on this type of DNA being present, which is called this alpha satellite DNA sequences. Okay, so it's okay. It's not clear right now, but it's going to be clear a little bit later.
Yeah,
I'll tell you more later. So,
my class is over. Dismissed.
So again, so you have these barriers, and then you have. So I guess to answer your question, I didn't specifically say this earlier. The barrier sequences contain some protein on them. I guess that's how they interact because that sequence of DNA is being recognized by that protein. So it's still the sequence that does it, but it's the protein that's an effector for it. Okay, so for example, this protein can join to the pore, right? Then it stops it, right? Because it can't get past its barrier, for example. Right? Okay. We kind of talked about this. So this is kind of how these guys are actually organized. You don't have to know the details, but again, there's this particular part that's forming the centromere. The centromere actually has a very complicated protein kind of attached to it, and it's kind of called the kinetochore complex. And this is the kinetochore complex that interacts with the microtubule to allow you to have the spindle attachment. But the short answer is you need kinetochore binding to centromere. Okay, so this is what I was saying about the alpha satellite sequences. You have a lot of repetition of these sites in particular areas. So in the inactive area, it doesn't really matter so much, but in the active area where the centromeres are, that allows you to have a more probability of that kinetochore attachment thing that happens, you know. Excuse me. And this is why I was saying that you can also have neocentromeres that don't have alpha satellites on them. Okay. Finally, we get to here, and I can take roll. How's that, huh? So we have 5 minutes to do this. Let me get out of this. Hopefully you guys can't read the next part. And I can take roll. Boom, it's gone. Damn it.
Top second from the top.
Damn it. Maybe I can read from here. Yay! Wei Hung. Not here. Not here. Taiki. Yay. Mark. Perfect. Woo. Yang. Okay. Shannon's here. Okay. That is Rachel. No. Jingyi. No Jingyi? Okay.
Sunny?
Oh, yes. Sunny. She is here, right? Okay. Is this Rachel? This must be Rachel. No. See you. Oh, this is Rachel. This is Rachel. Sorry.
Rachel.
I just couldn't see past the thing.
Han
is here. Okay. Yurina? Right? Okay. He's here. Kyung? Not here. Jinghee? Jinghee is here. Christopher is here. Lit is here. Elise is here. Ellen is not here.
Hang on. I know.
Is this correct? Okay, we're getting almost more than half. It's good. Oops. You guys just wanted the answers because it's
yes,
almost. Okay, but did you think about it before I... So Quilmington Remodeling Complex, we talked about this, right? So it does that, it does that, interacts with chaperones, it exchanges those guys, so boom, it's all the above. Okay, now, acetylation, I gave you the answer here also, right? So let's talk about why it's not true, the other guys, okay? It's sufficient from formation of an open Quilmington structure. It's nothing to do with that. This is not about... yeah, okay. Loosens structure because it adds positive charge. Actually...
Tightens things because
exactly.
It adds positive charges.
Exactly. It's actually how you form the heterochromatin, right? Recruits the heterochromatin protein HP1, results in establishment...
Not relevant to this.
It's not the thing that's... Exactly. Yeah. Those are the reader complex, writer complex is the thing that's actually doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Covalent modification is reversible, right? It's reversible. It's not irreversible, right? But anyways, the key thing is that they basically compete with each other, and when you methylate them now, you cannot demethylate, or you cannot acetylate easily. Okay, so I have 10 minutes. This part of the course, I will... kind of, because I really do need to go to replication. I promise you guys to do replication in the next lecture. I mean, today's okay. So what that means is that whatever I don't finish here, I will kind of briefly talk about next time. But again, I will make sure you know more or less what you need to know.
Or you can modify the exam so that...
Yes, I will also modify the exam to account for what was known and what was not known. Okay. Okay, so the next lecture is very less. It's less than 35% of the remaining lecture. Okay. And that part of it is to go from the chromatin structure now that you have into the chromosome structure. Right? So into the still more or less local 30 nanometer structure into the global karyotype structure. We talked about a little bit this before, and I want you guys to know about human alpha cell like DNA sequences, right? So these are, we call them seed events, which means that you're allowed into the central mirror to form, basically, right? So, and you have these CEMPA histones that allows it to have it be, you know, to actually happen. So in humans, you need the alpha cell.
Is this histone part of the kinetochore complex or not?
It is... The kinetochore itself is calling this entire thing part of the kinetochore.
Okay.
So yes, the answer is yes. So this histone is the thing that's sitting at the central mirror. It recruits that spindle fiber, but the kinetochore then also has some other protein. Yeah. So we kind of talk about this epigenetic modification, so I'll skip that. Now, you have these 30 nanometer fiber, they actually go into more loops and coils. So this is kind of a common theme of this entire section of the course, right? It's more and more organization. If you don't know, then they still kind of round among each other. So it turns out the DNA is actually found in this loop structure, too. So in addition to the How many is it? These are a string, zigzag, whatever, solenoid, zigzag, into this complicated structure, and it's still kind of loopy. Okay, so this is what the loops look like that. Alright, so extended loop structure, condensed or uncondensed, still.
So it's folded in half on itself from the very beginning?
What do you mean at the very beginning?
It's not one strand, it's two strands that are being...
Yeah, these are sister chromatids. This is not...
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Again, additional... So right now, forget all the sequence stuff, basically. This is all global structure. So none of this is... In fact, that's why we emphasize epigenetics, because this stuff is basically epigenetic-type stuff. Okay, so all beyond the DNA. So the actual position of it, yeah, it's not important. You don't have to know how it gets to that position. Okay? Okay, so... Right, so this is kind of something we already talked about, is how you get from heterochromatin to a form that you can, or how that form is kind of spreadingly activate over the form that can be accessed, right? So this is the loop structure. This is what the loop structure actually looks like, you know, when you actually look in the microscope. Now, this part is basically talking about how you actually study these guys, right? So, so the idea basically is that it's a little bit complicated, but I'll try to see if I can cut you some slack. So basically the idea is that in order to study these guys, so in other words, in order to study where you are getting these loop structures, right, for example, right, is that what you do is you have DNA binding proteins already there. Now, you have the probes, okay? The probes are just a specific DNA sequence that binds to some specific area of the DNA. Now, you don't particularly know where these guys are, right? So when you do the cutting with an restriction enzyme, and then you ligate the edges together back, you're getting rid of a lot of guys that you know basically are not in the structure. Now, if this probe now is found in the same sequence, that means these guys were close to each other initially. You get that? It's very ingenious, right? So in other words, you cut away all the guys who don't work next to this DNA binding protein, and then you ask, can I amplify this sequence? If I can amplify it, that means my probes were next to each other. And that is the place where the loops are going to form, or whatever you want to study. You see what I'm saying? This is how people study these things. Some people are understanding, some people are not, but I don't have time.
Study what? Structure or?
Structure, mostly structure. In this case, it's looking at the loops, but yeah. It's okay. If you don't understand, it's okay. Ask somebody who does. No, I'm just kidding. No, no. If this is just a way to study it. So this is just saying, okay, I know the sequence here and there, but I don't know where the loops are being formed, for example, or where this, you know, things happen. So what you do is you do the whatever you need to do, in this case DNA binding protein, and then you put the probes on. You have different probes, obviously, right? If this probe didn't work, you know, for example, if you put probe A here and probe B over here somewhere, then the nuclease digested it. Boom, you're not getting PCR products, right? No, no, you want a longer sequence because the longer sequence allows you to specifically specify that DNA. Because it's possible that you have a repeat too, right? I mean, if you just bind AC, AT, whatever, okay, you're going to get a shitload of probes back, right? So you want to be long enough to get specificity, and then you try different probes until you find that particular area where you're getting the binding well. So that's how you study these guys.
How many base pairs is a probe usually? Like 5 or 50?
More than 50.
More than 50.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's pretty, it's there, it's up there. Yeah. Okay, so this is what the loops look like. Boom. Okay.
I blinked.
Okay, boom, this is what the loops look like. Okay. Now, I don't have so much time, but okay. So I want to get to the final question, actually. So it turns out a lot of times people study chromosomes using these creatures that have polyteam chromosomes, which means they have more than two copies, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to study the distinct banding a little bit easier. Most of the DNA, like we were saying, is actually kind of condensed, right? Heterochromatized or some form. And there's actually different types of heterochromatization. I didn't tell you that, but there's actually different types of that. They don't do exactly the same way, and they actually form slightly different structures as well. When you need to actually access them, you can actually need to decondense the loops, and then it allows you to have gene expression within those loops, right? So I think that's okay. Too much detail. These are what kind of these guys look like, the banding structure of a polyteam, right? So this is saying more than two copies. This is kind of what happens when you look at the band. So this depends on basically what thing you use to color these guys, what they look like. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily mean it's functional, right? Okay, so within the nucleus, you actually have sub-organization, sub-compartmentalization. So that's kind of important. Okay, that's the part that I want to emphasize just before we finish. Okay, is that basically the if you notice, this is actually a picture of what the different chromosomes look like in the decondensed form in interface in the nucleus. So what this means is that, for example, chromosome 1 is mostly here, you know, lined up with the pore. You know, there's probably some proteins that's telling them to situate themselves there. So even when it's decondensed, it's kind of, it's organized. There's subcompartmentalization, okay? This is kind of what some of the subcompartmentalization look like. It can also be onsen tamago.
Can you tell something from that?
Yes. this is kind of more or less how the territories work. You have little bundles of things, right? Kind of. So this is kind of this zigzag-ish arrangement, but now an additional level of rounding up on top of each other. Do I need to talk about this? So this is just saying that depending on where you position yourself, okay? So what I was just saying is about how you position yourself, right? But depending on how you position yourself, you can also have an additional level of modification of activity. Because, for example, if you put this guy here, right? Don't worry about what it's saying here. This is just saying how you get there. But if you put this guy here next to the nuclear pore, now you can't turn on the gene so easily because it's next to all this machinery, all this protein complex. But when you put it somewhere else, like out here in the open, now these guys can be activated, basically. So the position of the actual chromosome, basically, but decondensed, allows you to have modification of activity.
Position with respect to the membrane or with respect to themselves?
With respect to where you are in the nucleus. It could be the membrane, but it could be with respect to other guys as well. Yeah. But in this case, it's highlighting the fact that it's with respect to the membrane. Yeah. So this is kind of the last piece of information I'll give you before we call it a day. Let me see how many slides I have left. Okay, that's okay. I can actually give you the question, actually, but because I don't want you to miss it. But this is the subcompartmentalization aspect of it. Remember, ribosomal RNA is going to be found its own kind of subcompartment, right, in the nucleolus. Now, the subcompartment is not always there. It's only forming when it's needed. So, in other words, you have some random diffusion, but if you need to have that set of genes being kind of activated all the time, then it's there. So otherwise, this is why I was saying that sometimes you tether it to the nuclear pore or sometimes other places. It's because there's a lot of dynamic movement and you only form that subcompartmentalization where all those chromosomes, all the DNA sequences from that particular chromosome and that particular set of genes are together only when it's needed, when it's specified. There's actually these are just two examples of subcompartmentalization, and that just has to do with the name for these are just basically when when people do hybridization to whatever to study them, this is what they look like. So they're calling them, you know, Cajal bodies, for example. They concentrate also into different reaction environments. So in other words, within the nucleus, if you have a favorable place where you have a lot of space and you have a lot of openness, you know, to allow you to have access, you're now going to have much more efficient access to them, right? So depending on where you're sitting, it's actually important. They actually also interact with the scaffolding matrix of the nucleus. Remember these, like the lamins, for example, the matrix of the nucleus. And when you have these chromatids actually line up, there's actually other proteins that coil the DNA into these loops and protect the DNA also. And that's also kind of an additional level of modification that helps you to help these guys line up. So I talk about the central mirror, but also you need these guys to kind of put them together. But they're just proteins. They're just proteins that are doing that. It was just giving you the names of these proteins. And the way that these proteins work, I don't have time to go over them. It's basically they form dimers. Okay, I don't have time to go over. So this is what it looks like. This is the organization I was talking about. This is chromatids. This is kind of nice to know, you know, because it captures everything we more or less talked about today, going from that double helix to the more zigzag form into complicated loops into central chromosome. Okay, so I will stop here. So basically, we're done with this lecture. The last part is just a little bit about evolution. So it's basically that I go over that in like 5-10 minutes next time and go straight into replication. And then probably that's what we have time for. If I have time, we would like to also summarize what we did so far. Okay? Cool. All right. How much time do I have?
Overtime.
3 minutes over. I'll give you the question for this set. Sure. You guys think about it. You know, it's okay if it, you know, you haven't completely figure it out. Yeah, it's okay. Don't worry about it. This is the question. Now, these questions are good because they're not, you know, you have to know some stuff and you have to be slightly logical. Right? So you guys can look at this, think about, if you look at this and say, oh, I know the answer, it's a good sign. All right.